This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight, we have two sponsors for the show, and those are Jam Software and XMA. We'll tell you more about both of those as the show goes on. Bradley, how are you?
Good, good. Getting ready here. It's storming here at my house, but we haven't had rain in 2 weeks, so I'm thankful for that. Okay. But into the full swing of summer. I'm still patiently waiting for my Apple School Manager invitation.
Me too.
I would like to get started on my iPad deployment, but I cannot.
Yeah, we're all kind of waiting for that now, aren't we? You know, we've all been so organized this time, and we're ready to go just as the school year ends, and we find ourselves waiting for Apple School Manager. But I actually phoned Apple Support to ask them what was going on this week, and they said we don't know anything about that. So I was like, "Here's my case ID."
I emailed my systems engineer and got an auto response back. Yep. So he was on vacation.
On vacation just before WWDC. Well, I suppose for SEs that's a quiet time, isn't it?
That's true. That's true. A couple things we get into the show this week. Fraser, you got something fun to announce?
Yeah, I have a new project which is extremely time sensitive. So if you are thinking about helping with this, please help soon. But let me tell you the backstory. If you remember Srini Swaminathan, who was on the show about a year or two ago, my friend from India, who has taught in numerous sort of low-income community schools in India, is now working with an organization called the Barefoot College, which is an organization that trains women in rural parts of India to basically be solar engineers, which is kind of a little bit mind-blowing considering that most of these women have very low or no levels of literacy at all with the written word. And the Barefoot College, they train them to build things like solar cookers, solar water heaters, desalination devices, and also, as Srini was telling me on Skype the other day, that they also have a solar-powered data projector for iPads, so they can charge it up during the day, and then they use it in the evenings when it gets dark to do night school for the mums who have got kids, and the kids are in bed at that point or sleeping, and they use those data projectors in the evening to teach classes and so on. So long story short, basically what it was that Srini emailed me and asked if we had any spare iPads that we could donate to the Barefoot College. And I said, well, no, we don't have any spares, but we do have a lease that's ending, and we do have an opportunity to buy out the lease for a certain amount of money. And then we could send them to you after that, as long as we can satisfy the leasing company with the money that they expect at the end of the lease. So what I'm trying to do between now and basically the end of August is I'm trying to raise just over £10,000 in order to buy out our lease. And that will get us 110 fourth generation iPads, basically the ones we've had in our school for 3 years, which are perfectly good. They're not obsolete in any sense. 32 gig devices, Wi-Fi devices. We'll get them, take title of them, and we'll send them off to the Barefoot College in India. So, and those will be used to help train the people who are learning these projects. Because of the generally low levels of literacy in the areas that they're working in, many of the trainings are animated, graphical, and you can imagine how the iPad helps greatly with that kind of education. So that's my project. And what I'm looking for is to really make use of the audiences that I have here and on Canvas and on some other podcasts that have kindly invited me on, or Srini on at some point, to raise this money. So if you would like to help with a donation to this project, the URL at the moment, I'm going to set up a redirect at spears.org/fundraising. I'm going to use a site called crowdfunder.co.uk. At the time of writing it, or the time of recording, it's not actually fully set up yet. So that's my job for the weekend. But by the time the show goes out, that page should be live. And hopefully some of you would feel moved to donate and help us with that. We have to raise just over £10,000, and that will enable us to buy all the devices, fix a couple of broken screens that we have, and have 110 working, good condition devices that we can send out to the Barefoot College, and they will be well used. Srini himself will be running the whole system and developing the training materials as well, and that's where they will go and have a new life, rather than just being recycled or sold off on eBay or whatever it is that leasing companies do with them. I think that's a much better use of that hardware. So I would really, really appreciate your support. And that would be, I'm sure everybody at Barefoot College would appreciate it as well.
Yeah, we'll have a link to that in the show notes. So if it's something where you wanted to, you know, donate to that, we would appreciate that. It's a great great use of a few extra dollars you have. One of the things, too, that's coming out, I guess, very soon this summer is our friends at Shobee have a kind of an evolution of their product where they're evolving into a lighter learning management system, is the term. It's pretty cool. So, when it comes to learning management systems or, you know, those kind of types of things, if you're like an iTunes or an iPad deployment, iTunes U is the natural fit. If you're a Chromebook deployment, Google Classroom is a natural fit. But I know a lot of schools that use a combination of both, and Shobee is a nice middle ground there. So it's evolving into more of an LMS for schools to use, and it works well on the iPad and Chromebooks as well. And it's obviously cloud hosted, so there's nothing, you know, nothing to install on servers. It's just very, very easy. Have groups, have a way to keep parents in the loop. You can have super portfolios. You could have live updates as well. Students can chat with you. You can share feedback and field questions. I'm in on the test flight beta. It's looking really, really nice. So again, if you're the type of school that has a combination iPad and Chromebook deployment, definitely check out, you know, Shobee this summer. Maybe a good fit for you. So pretty cool news from our friends at Shobee.
You know, the thing I'm looking for from an LMS is the ability to sort of lock out the feature where students can message you by about 10 p.m. the night before something is due. That needs to be a sort of blackout period, because that's when all the excuses come flying in. Now, to be honest with you, now that I'm thinking about that and having said that, I haven't, this year, we've used iTunes U intensively this year. I've never used it as much as I have this year. And to be fair to the kids in school, they really haven't done that very often. It's the kind of thing, that was a thing, you know, in the first year or two of iTunes U, but nowadays, I think not only are the kids getting better at managing their time, but I think also teachers are getting better at sort of getting the right chunk of work that you can send out through iTunes U, and also we're getting better at thinking about what you can ask students to do by themselves, you know, and how to set it up and how to give them a task that they can start by themselves without having to have a teacher start them all off in the lesson first. And that's something that, you know, whether you're using Shobee or iTunes U, that's an important skill for teachers to develop. I don't know if I could quantify that myself, but I think it's something I've spent a bit of time trying to be careful about, and it's seemingly starting to pay off a little bit.
One other thing, too, I felt to mention is integration with Google Apps. With, you know, a lot of our schools use that, and then it works well on iPad Pro with the Pencil.
Oh, very nice.
Pretty cool stuff. So, yeah, so that's a good. It's like you can always tell a app developer on iOS who's a good steward of the platform when they're integrating like Apple Pencil this early.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, definitely check that out from our friends at Shobee. Effortless to deploy and manage as well. So congrats to them. Before we move on to tonight's main topic, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at XMA. XMA is a leading Apple solution expert for education. As an Apple solution expert for education, XMA is perfectly positioned to support your institution with the deployment of iPad and Mac. They have 30 years of experience, and they've used this to create the unique All Learn program. All Learn with Apple supports you with planning, financing, and managing your iPad and Mac deployments. XMA can use their accredited trainers to deliver Apple professional development workshops to teachers and staff to ensure you get the best results for your Apple products with your investment into your school. To learn more about the All Learn program and XMA, check out xma.co.uk/out-of-school. If you want to connect with them on Twitter, it's @WeAreXMA. So again, that's xma.co.uk/out-of-school. Thanks to XMA for sponsoring the show this week. So we thought tonight, as we kind of really come up upon WWDC here in a, 10 days from the time of our recording, it's very, very soon. Look at kind of like where's the hanging fruit for iOS for us? And I'll tell you, some of these things are things I've been asking for years, and a lot of them are new. And I think one of the things that's happened is iOS has matured, you know. But people say, oh, the low-hanging fruit for these platforms is gone. There's, you know, I remember when copy and paste was a wish list item. That as we kind of like go further and further into these platforms, we see little edge cases that, again, like, and I'll give an example of one we're going to talk about later, is screen recording. So that's the kind of one, like, not everybody needs that. That's not a feature that's like a tentpole item at a WWDC keynote. But that's one of those features that people that use that can make the difference on them being able to use that platform full time or not. Because now people that need to do iOS screen recording, they have to use a Mac and use QuickTime.
Yeah, I think with things like that as well, it's starting to look increasingly sort of absurd that there are two or three really important things that you have to go back and use a Mac for. You know, like screen recording on your iOS device, you have to go and buy a £1,000 Mac just to do that. You know, installing, well, they solve the installing beta versions of iOS, but like restoring an iOS device, you've got to go and get a Mac for that. So I think just another sort of step along the evolution of the iOS devices as the, you know, completely standalone computer platforms. And that's, of course, gotten better and better over the years. But, you know, the only people who think there's no low-hanging fruit left in iOS are people who don't use iOS very much, or perhaps people who maybe only use a phone. But on iPad users, there's certainly plenty of low-hanging fruit left when you're trying to do non-smartphone-type tasks. You know, those tasks where you sit down at your iPad for, you know, 2 to 3 hours at a time and you work on a project that involves integrating multiple steps and disparate applications. You know, nobody who does that thinks there's no low-hanging fruit left in iOS, that's for sure.
Yeah, so we'll run through this, and we kind of broken these up into various sections. So we'll start off with the user interface. And first thing is something that, now that I have an iPad Pro and I have multitasking, the app picker for multitasking has got to go.
Yes, it does. And I think we knew this last year as well, actually, to be fair. It's something that has, you know, it only barely coped with, you know, in the iOS 9 betas where the only apps that supported it were Apple's apps. And none of the third-party apps supported it at all. Even that was already annoying, never mind when you've got 150 apps that support multitasking. So yeah, I completely agree that's got to go. It's got to get a lot faster, and it's got to just be a lot more sort of information dense. And this is, of course, where new low-hanging fruit grows all the time, because as soon as you put in a feature like multitasking, like Apple Pencil support, you suddenly get apparently seemingly very obvious things that weren't implemented in the first version to be implemented later on as well. So yeah, that's. I really need that to be faster. I need, you know, if you've seen Federico Vitici's iOS 10 wishlist, he does a really nice, it's a YouTube video, but he has a really nice kind of idea for the way that could work. So you're able to search it, you can pin favorites to the top, and then it's a much more information dense view below as well. So yeah, that to me is one of the big things about iOS on the iPad, is that is just a clunky part of the system.
Yes, yeah, it feels like it was like hatched in about an hour, and they just haven't gotten to it yet. Hey, a funny story I heard about the reason we still don't have like a native weather app for mm-hmm. iPad and native calculator. Have you heard about why?
I've heard some stories about why, but I don't know if any of them are actually true. What do you know?
Yeah, the one I heard, again, it could not be true. What I heard most recently is that when they originally showed it to Steve Jobs, they were basically just blown up versions of the iPhone ones with like native resolution. Yeah. And he hated them because they didn't take advantage of the screen. And so they said, well, we'll just won't do them this year. And they just never got back to them because, let's be real, I mean, do you want like a better multitasking app picker or a better weather app for this built in?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, third parties have absolutely taken up that slack, so it's not something I would put a lot of resources into on iOS either.
So what's next?
I think this was one of your ideas, Bradley, force split screen for universal apps.
Yeah, and so I realize there's a ton of technical challenges mm-hmm. around this, and this is more of a oddball thing. It frustrates me how there's still some apps that that don't support like multitasking and split yeah. screen. So if there's a way almost Apple could force this, or let me just somehow view the iPhone resolution of a universal app on my iPad.
Yeah, I think, you know, something like that would be very welcome, because it is killing me that there are some apps that don't support split screen just now. You know, Google apps, of course, we're looking at them. But even things like iTunes U, you know, some Apple apps don't fully support split screen either. iTunes U is really hurting me that that's not working, because, you know, quite often you're making up a lesson in one window and you want to have, you know, your photos in the other window to see what you're going to pick and put in the post or something like that. Or even, you know, just a separate document that you've been working on or whatever. And not having that there is, it really grinds now. It's been a while. You know, what's that, nearly, you know, 10 months or something since we first, well, nearly, it's come up for a year since we first saw split screen multitasking. So, I mean, it's such a big change under the hood that I don't blame Apple for not having force developers to support it yet. And of course, it's not appropriate for every app, but I think, you know, it would be very welcomed, you know, to be able to have some expectation that most apps are on a path to supporting this. You know, if Apple say, right, by iOS 10, unless you're a game, you've got to support, or iOS 11 perhaps, unless you're a game, you've got to support split screen multitasking or something like that. That would be very welcome, but I understand the challenges, but as a user, I don't really care about the challenges. I just want these apps to do what I want them to do.
Yeah, we expect magic to be done.
Yeah, we do, you know, and I think expecting, you know, those apps to support multitasking in the first month of the iPad's, you know, multitasking existence is unrealistic. But after a year, okay, I think that's pretty reasonable to expect that to happen by that point.
So next thing is bulk operation for document pickers, document providers. And 100% agree here. You know, it pains me using, you know, when you're like trying to insert documents into an email, if you're entering, I mean, we all often add 2 to 3, you know, PDFs or whatever to an email, and that the current setup, you must individually add each one.
Yeah. And I think this is something that could be, you know, the document provider system is kind of overloaded in iOS in the sense that it can do the one user interface element and the one API call can do multiple different things depending on how you set it up. And I think that's an architectural decision that has confused people, because, you know, you get that situation where, for example, in Dropbox, you sometimes see the message Dropbox can't open files, because Dropbox's plugin doesn't support one of the modes that it works with. So what we're looking for here is basically a way for you to go into a document picker, look at your Google Drive, let's say, maybe select multiple files, put them on a shelf somewhere, and then press a button at the end that says go, and it delivers 5 or 6 files back to your application instead of just one at a time. Because particularly if you're navigating like deep into a Dropbox hierarchy or deep into Google Drive hierarchy, going back to that same place to get a file that was right next to the one you were looking at in the first place, it gets old very, very fast. And it's something that I think, as iOS develops as a productivity platform, bulk operation is kind of like the next frontier of a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, I totally, totally agree.
The same also goes for anywhere where you're dealing with a list of items in an iOS app. There needs to be sort of there is sort of support for doing this, but there needs to be maybe better built-in support, I don't know, for, you know, select all and do something with all of these things instead of just one at a time.
So next thing, let's really look at expanding Control Center and being able to customize it.
Yeah, because, I mean, what in Control Center do you never touch, Bradley?
The calculator app. The AirDrop, I don't really change that too much. And don't use Night Shift in there because it's all automatic. I honestly don't use the camera in there because it's faster for me to get to the icon than it is to swipe up in a lot of situations. And screen brightness, I don't really touch that in there. It's all automatic. Yeah. So I would like to, I mean, there's a lot of opportunity there to expand that with 3D Touch, where like if you did 3D Touch on like Wi-Fi, you could bring up a list of like networks it sees. So there's a lot of opportunity there. But those icons, I mean, it's like those. I should be able to tap and hold and hit the X and add new things. I mean, there's plenty of opportunity to add, you know, different, you know, VPNs, for example.
Yeah, I think there's certainly the screen brightness one is, you know, that's mostly controlled by sensors now. And Night Shift, you know, either you have it on or you don't. I think there's not often a call for switching it off or whatever. Because I think iOS also is quite clever about Night Shift in that if you go into the Photos app, it turns Night Shift off. Am I right about that? You know, just so it doesn't distort the color of your photographs.
Yeah, let's test that.
Testing.
I don't have any photos on my camera at all.
You must be the only person in the world for whom that's true.
No, it's staying on.
Oh, that's interesting. I thought there was something about that. Maybe it's only on certain hardware. Maybe it's only on certain hardware. Or maybe that was a True Tone display that did that. I'm not sure. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm using my phone.
Of course, you've got an iPad with True Tone display as well. Yeah, the calculator app, I mean, that's one that I never do. But I always use the Control Center camera as my shortcut to camera. I don't have the camera app on my home screen at all. Maybe because I don't have a 3D Force Touch iPhone either. Because, you know, if I did have that, you would want to get those options out there. But yeah, there's definitely things that you would put in there. I mean, for me, you know, as soon as I set up a new iPhone, I turn AirDrop on to everyone and I just leave it there forever. You know, I don't really have the need to have that, you know, turning on, turning off quite as accessible. And also, I would quite like to be able to configure school iPads to take the Bluetooth button out of Control Center to stop kids footing with Bluetooth as well, which is now quite important for Apple Classroom as well.
Yeah, yeah. It just, yeah, and I think 3D, that's an opportunity where 3D Touch could be very, very handy, like I said earlier. So, it'd be, and it's, Control Center's really not been touched functionally since it was introduced. And I think there's a lot of opportunity there to make things faster, you know, keep me from having to go to the settings app so often.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Next thing, what's next on the list?
A better emoji keyboard.
Yes, 100%.
Because, it, I mean, how many emojis are there now? Like 1,000 or something? And the number is going to grow again and again and again with new Unicode releases that come out as well. So the idea to maybe, you know, be able to search the keyboard for certain emojis or pin ones to the front that you really like, even if you don't use them all that frequently, you want to have them up there. Something like that would be very welcome, I think, because the scrubbing bar on the iPad is helpful, but, you know, there's just so many that you're scrolling at any reasonable speed is starting to get quite blurry, so... Yeah, yeah, something better, and I figured out a much better idea than just improve it, make it easier to search, and maybe pin some of them up to the front would be great.
So next on the list is, this is kind of an oddball one that most of you might eye roll at. It is some sort, this is my idea, some sort of external way to interface with iOS without touching the screen. And so here's my rationale behind that. At my desk, I have my keyboard at the proper ergonomic level. And I have my laptop and my external monitor at eye level.
Okay.
There's currently really no, there would be no way for me to recreate that with iOS. Because otherwise, I guess I could do the keyboard, but I'm still going to have to touch up and actually like reach pretty high to touch the screen. And so some sort of way, I don't know if it's an external trackpad of some sort, and I don't even know how this is possible, but some way to interact with iOS without touching the screen.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, that, because essentially all you would need to do is, I say all, but, you know, add the cursor back into iOS. You know, macOS has had a cursor forever. And, you know, when you simulate iOS apps on a Mac, when you're building them, you operate the interface with a cursor. You use your trackpad and you click with the pointer on the interface elements you would normally touch. My concern about doing that would be that developers start to build it for touch, for the, you know, the pointer device rather than your fingertip. So that might be something that would have to be looked at quite carefully in app review. But I kind of get your point, you know, and I think that it would be interesting to see if there was some way in which you could kind of reinvent the pointer for the touchscreen world. You know, you see in the Apple demo videos, there's that kind of gray dot that floats around to indicate where somebody's touching the screen when there's no finger in the video. Maybe something like that. You know, you could use that to simulate touch on the device remotely. That could happen.
Yeah, never know. And this is one of those, as the platform matures, you can go down these routes.
Yeah, I don't think that idea is as crazy as it sounds on first. You know, you said that was one of the kind of out there ideas. I don't know that we're going to see it right away, but I think it's not as far outside the bounds of possibility as you might think.
I think it's more likely we'll see that than we will touch brought to the Mac.
Yeah, I think that's never going to happen, because you think about the complexity of the user interface metrics for Mac. If you've ever used any kind of remote desktop application on an iPad, to touch a Mac interface is not a pretty scene. And that's something that I think will probably never happen. But you can imagine how, if you've already got a well-spaced out user interface for touch, then, you know, touching it with a cursor is obviously going to be just as easy, because the cursor will necessarily be smaller than the finger.
So if we move on to our next section, let's thank our last sponsor of the night. It's the great folks at Jamf Software. They provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power your Apple devices in the classroom and in your schools. Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs. Casper is my choice for mobile device management. They had day one support for iOS 9.3 features, not just iOS 9.3, but iOS 9.3 features. Again, I can't say enough about them. You can run basically anything. They can run on a Mac on your own infrastructure. They can run on Linux. They can run on Amazon, AWS. We're using their hosted option, so I don't have to worry about any of these software updates. They just handle it for me. So again, if you're checking out mobile device management for your iPad deployment this summer, check out the Casper Suite from Jamf Software. You can learn more about them at jampsoftware.com, JAMFsoftware.com. So next section we have is Safari. And I think this is one of the keys and one of the, in some ways one of the weakest aspects of iOS.
Yeah, I think it's, Safari has, you know, we're so spoiled because if you think back to the beginning of iPhone, like Safari on iPhone was just absolutely revelatory. It was amazing, and it still is very good at rendering web pages. You know, it's not that bad, but it's really the kind of the bits that go around it that I find more difficult right now. And the first one is the need for a Safari download manager. You know, and Federico and I talked about this on Canvas a number of shows ago. But the fact that Safari just doesn't have any kind of download manager means that if you ever want to interact with files that you're downloading from the web or uploading to the web, you tend to get pushed off into an alternative browser such as iCab or Documents by Readle or something like that, rather than just being able to do it in Safari.
Yeah, it's funny how the web has changed, because when the iPhone was obviously pitched, it was the full web right in your pocket, and the web has changed to help be better on iOS in reality.
Yeah, in some ways and in some ways not. I mean, I think it remains frustrating to me that there are so many websites you go to where it's crystal clear that the people who use this or who design the site have literally never tested it on a tablet device. You know, and I'm talking about things like where you still have, you know, mouse over interaction. I mean, you know, that's something that's really annoying. You have to sort of tap on it and then tap on it again. You know, Safari does have a way to get around some of that stuff, but the number of people who know that that's how you do it is probably rounding down to about 0% overall, which kind of leads me to my next kind of request for Safari, which is permanent desktop mode for certain websites. So you know that in some cases, if you go to, say, I don't know, Wikipedia or something, you get a kind of mobile-like interface on Safari. To be able to say in Safari, look, for this website, always use desktop mode. If there's a website you know doesn't do a thing you need it to do on the mobile version that it detects and sends to Safari, then being able to say, look, always take me to this particular website on a desktop version, I think would be very, very useful.
Well, and I wonder if there's a way, I doubt it, but I know like in the content blocker I use, you can whitelist websites. And I'm more if there's a way to, I don't know, more if there's a way for content blocker to implement that.
Yeah, I think what would have to happen is it would have to be part of the outbound request. I'm not that sure how websites work anymore. I mean, my website skills sort of ended with HTML4, but the browser would have to identify itself in some way as different when it's connecting to the site in the first place, rather than just filtering what comes in on the back end. Because the reason that wouldn't work is because the content blocker system is specifically designed so the content blocker cannot take dynamic action based on what you're doing, right? All you're doing is with a content blocker is you compile a list of rules and you deliver those rules to Safari, and then Safari itself implements the filtering. The content blocker is effectively just an editor for a rule set, but then it's no longer involved in it once you're browsing. And that's kind of part of the design, so that you have privacy from what the content blockers see as well. They only know which sites you're blocking or what content you're blocking. They don't know what sites you hit while you were having that content blocked.
Good point.
Privacy.
Oh, me. Okay. So, last thing on Safari is, I still think, is the weakest area of Safari, yep, and that is text selection. And I don't know how much of this is to blame on crappy web developers as much as it is iOS. All I know is I can easily select text on the desktop. Sometimes on iOS, it is like raising the dead.
Yes, but somehow less pleasant. It's something that is a bugbear all over the web on iOS, and it's just Safari has a sort of tendency to, when you're selecting on lines, it will eventually, if for some reason, try and jump you into bounding box based text selection, and then you can pull the north, south, east, and west points of that bounding box out to expand the selection. And why it jumps across that boundary, I don't know. And on different websites, it seems to sort of apply different rules for that depending on what's going on. So yeah, I would like to see that massively improved in iOS 10.
So next section we have is the Photos app. Mm-hmm. So what do we have first?
So I love Photos app, and I'm a huge big user of Photos app. You know, I have, you know, over 30,000 photographs in my iCloud photo library. And really what I'm looking for out of iOS 10 is better folder organization support in iOS. Now, if you use iCloud photo library on the Mac and iOS, you can make a folder structure on the Mac and it will sync to iOS. And you can also create a folder structure on iOS, and that will sync between iOS devices. But say you make a folder in another folder, and then you want to, you fill it up with photographs and then you want to move that folder somewhere else, you can't do that on iOS for some reason. You can do it on the Mac and it'll sync back. But basically the iOS Photos app doesn't have support for organizing folders properly. And I think that's something that would be very welcome in iOS 10. And also along with that, the ability to sort of have sort of smart albums that go along with that. And that's something where, you know, some processing could happen in the cloud on that. I don't know if it's maybe an issue of they don't want to have too much processing load on the actual iOS device, but you could probably do something in the cloud with that, I'm sure.
So last thing for photos is rejecting apps that don't properly work with iCloud Photo Library.
Yeah, and this is my personal crusade in this one. There are a huge number of apps still, including some Apple apps actually, where if you have an iCloud Photo Library turned on that optimizes the storage away from the user, from the device. So if your thumbnails are on the device and your photos are in the cloud, then the photo picker will only show you the ones that are cached on your device, and it won't show you the ones that are up in the cloud, and it won't show you the proper structure of your photo library as well. So this is not really a feature of iOS 10 as much as a change in attitude for app review, which is that they should be testing it with optimized iCloud Photo Libraries. And if those apps aren't working properly with them, they should be starting to reject them, I think.
Next section is education / productivity. First thing we have on the list is support for broadcasting the teacher screen to the students.
Yeah, so this is something that this is kind of in, you know, when Apple Classroom comes out, you know, we're delighted to have what it brings. And then immediately you want something new. And it's been great to have the ability to look at the student screen, but being able to maybe take the teacher screen and send it to the pupils would be a very interesting idea, because it would mean then that students could, along maybe even as picture in picture while they're looking at something else as well. That would be really powerful, I think, because it would enable you to do things maybe separate from what's up on a projector. You could say, oh, here's another thing that I'm looking at, and students could have two sort of experiences going on at once. I think that would be a useful feature to have.
Next thing, and we mentioned this earlier, is be able to do screen recording on device. There's an app that did this for about an hour previously. Yes. Video was the name of it?
Video with a Y, yes.
And it did it with an AirPlay trick, basically making the iPad an AirPlay receiver, and it would record that. But we really just need something like this. I don't even know how you'd implement it. Maybe it's pressing the home screen button four times or something to start it. But this something needs to happen.
Yeah, it's one of these things where, you know, when you say it to people, they say, well, who wants to do that in iOS? And the answer is, well, I'm sure tons of people want to do it in iOS, but they don't talk about it because they know they can't do it. So fine. But, you know, developers might want to do it if they've got their app and they want to do a native recording of their app, for example. Anybody doing instruction on iOS really would like to do that, because then you could record videos of you using an application, and then, you know, you can store that, send it to pupils, whatever, anything like that. And also just reporting bugs to developers. I've actually got video, and I've mostly used it to send video strange behaviors in apps and send it to the developer. And that's an increasing way of sort of reporting bugs. The developers seem to really welcome that, because they can actually see live what is going on with their app when you're encountering the problem that you're seeing.
So the next one, this is a big one. Drum roll, please. Xcode for iOS. Yeah. This, in some ways, I'm not going to say is symbolic, but it would go. I mean, that's the thing I hear from a lot of people is I can't use iOS only because I'm a developer.
Yeah. I think this is, you know, it is important, but you're right about the sort of symbolism of it as well. It was more than a symbolism, though, because it would be a milestone for the iOS platform if you could develop for the platform on the platform. You know, and we're sort of 10 years into the iOS era now, and we're still in a situation where the previous platform is still required to develop for this platform. And, you know, when it's phones and watches and TVs, I get it. But if you look at, for example, an app like Pythonista, you know, some people said to me when I talked about this on Twitter, they said, oh, well, you could never bring Xcode to iOS. Xcode's far too complicated. You know, it couldn't be done. And then you look at what Pythonista can do, where you've got actual, you know, Python editor, debugger, interactive console, and a user interface development system all built into Pythonista. And that's developed by one guy. who is a brilliant developer, but still a team of one. You know, don't tell me that Apple couldn't bring that to iOS. And some people said, well, there's technical and security reasons, but Apple has, you know, from time to time, let themselves do things other people were not allowed to do in iOS. So it's not obvious to me at all in the world of a 256 gigabyte iPad Pro why Xcode for iOS shouldn't exist. Now, I don't think that it's going to support all kinds of legacy tool chains. I mean, I can't see them bringing over like Mac development to the iPad. A, it doesn't make sense. And B, why would you, you know, spend your engineering resources to have it be able to be done the other way? But certainly bringing Swift development to iOS, bringing iPad user interface and iPhone user interface design to a native iOS device, and bringing, hopefully bringing the whole build to iOS, is, you know, to me that's something that's got to happen. But I think perhaps in the first instance, what we might see is what they call Swift Playgrounds, which is these kind of interactive programming documents that you can write with Swift, which seem to be very popular in education. I haven't really used them because, of course, there are no Swift tools in iOS, but I really feel that the time is ripe for Xcode for iOS to come out.
I agree. Next thing is support for an ink overlay on the screen. So the idea was you could freeze a screen wherever you're at, mark up on it, and then save that, obviously, to the camera roll or a document provider.
Yeah. And this is mainly for things like, you know, say you were trying to make an instructional slideshow or something, being able to capture a screen and then, you know, maybe just draw an arrow on it or something, or just freeze the screen in front of a class so that nothing will change underneath you while you're highlighting certain parts of the interface. But if you could do it with an ink overlay, I think that would be, I would really, really enjoy that. And I know several situations where I would use that quite freely, actually.
Thinking something here with like, maybe even like, in addition to this, might be like a presentation mode where it maybe like blocks on all notifications. And I know that you do not disturb as part of that, but you see what I'm saying? Like, it's kind of like how when you plug your Mac up to a projector, it kind of puts it doesn't show any notifications for anything.
Yeah, I think iOS devices can definitely be smarter about that. You know, blocking notifications, or at least visual notifications for one thing. And also, putting a dot on the screen where you've touched would be really, really powerful. You know, if you ever go to the Genius Bar and you see those video screens they have behind the Genius Bar where it shows you how to do things in iOS, and the finger is represented by a floating gray dot that touches down on the interface. To have that sort of automatically generated on the screen when you touch your iPad, because the people in the audience can't see you where you're touching. So you have to, you know, I don't know if you've ever done this in front of a group, Bradley, but you sort of touch the button and then you move your finger on and off it to make it flash, you know, things like that to try and highlight what it is you're touching. But having a presentation mode where that is shown automatically would be huge.
Okay, what's next on the screen? More reliable AirPlay mirroring.
Yes, 100% is my goal. It's definitely gotten better, right? Let's be fair enough about that. It's definitely gotten better over the past couple of releases, but it's still not as reliable as a cable. And, you know, okay, wireless, you know, is not as reliable as wired, but I think both sides could do a better job of detecting that the connection has fallen over and re-establishing it if possible, rather than that being a thing that the user has to interact with as well.
Next thing on the list, a richer notification center. And this is kind of goes along with the control center one. Both of these are ways to get things done in iOS faster without necessarily making it changing from iOS to something else.
I mean, I think one of the things that would be powerful in Notification Center is just the ability for widgets to take text entry. So if you had, say, an OmniFocus widget, you could actually just create a new item right in Notification Center rather than having to use a button in Notification Center to then launch the app, to then hit a button in the app, to then type something in. If you could just grab it right there, I think that would be great.
Next thing on the list is, this was yours, and I totally agree. Generally pay more attention to the number of taps to do things. And I'll give you a perfect example of this in my real life. It takes about 9 taps to get money out of the ATM. That's way too many.
Yeah.
And I think this is especially where like a Fantastical totally kills Apple's calendar app.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the main ways that people have worked around things like, you know, the new appointment dialog box in Calendar is just a disaster of tap, 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 because, you know, you've got to type in the address or the item, maybe type in a location, set a start date and time, and those start dates and end dates and times, you have to tap once to reveal the picker as well, and then close the picker again, go to the next one and so on. And I'm reminded of back in the old days with Palm Pilots, that there was somebody or maybe many people at Palm whose job it was to go around and just count how many taps it took to do certain things. And, you know, Palm was a very early, you know, almost smartphone product. But they did a really good job of being very sensitive to the fact that you're probably standing in front of a busy person while you're trying to enter this information. And of course, back in the days of Palm, culturally, people wouldn't put up with you standing in front of them, fiddling with a computer thing when you could have just written it down in a paper diary and they would be on with their job, particularly if you were an assistant or something like that. So I think just in general, having faster ways to set things up in iOS would be welcome. And I don't know, again, if that's not necessarily a feature of iOS 10, but maybe some redesign thinking of some of the user interface elements, and maybe just a bit more messaging and a bit more encouragement at WWDC for people to think about that sort of thing. I think that would go a long way.
Yeah, I've been really kind of thinking about this lately because I've set up my wife's iPhone twice this week because she had like her vibrate button, like the mm-hmm. switch to change it from vibrate to ring, broke, and like it just would wiggle. Mm-hmm. So I had insurance with AT&T and they sent me a refurbished phone. Well, that phone was garbage. Yeah. And like it actually would type on its own.
What?
It's like a possessed iPhone. Like
dropped in water or something?
No, like it would just, yeah, I don't know, like it, like she'd be like holding it and it would just like start launching apps. And she thought I'd hacked her phone. And then like you'd type like, you hit backspace and you'd type an M. Mm. Like it was just something was off with the touch. And so we'd send another one. So I basically restored her phone from iCloud twice. And not having to do the whole thing where you have to update the phone and then rewipe it and then restore again, that's really, really nice. But yeah, just like little things there, you know. Sweat the details on the number of taps.
Yeah,
I guess is the. All right, so next thing is a sysadmin section. We've gotten a ton here this year.
We're spoiled.
So this is like these. So what's the first thing we have?
First thing is I mentioned this earlier. Just full on-device restoring. So if you have a Mac, you can hold down Command R when you boot, and that takes it into recovery mode, which can do things like connect to Wi-Fi, download the new version of OS X. And then install it, erase your hard drive and so on. Basically do kind of emergency maintenance stuff that gets your computer back up and running, even if it's slow when it comes off the internet. iOS devices don't have this capability. Yes, you can do erase all content and settings, which resets everything to default on the version of iOS that's on your device right now. But what you cannot do is you cannot do a full device restore over the air on an iOS device natively. You've got to go back and plug it into iTunes on a Mac, put it into DFU mode, have iTunes download the whole package and restore it by itself. And I think some capability like that for an iOS device would be very, very valuable, particularly in a world where less and less you're having a Mac around, particularly when it comes to sysadmin. You know, I still do have a Mac available in school. It's our Apple configurator machine, so we can do that kind of stuff. But for example, actually at home, that's something that's been more difficult, you know. I'm kind of like digging around behind the TV trying to plug in a lightning cable into our Plex server, which is kind of like the last remaining Mac in the house, whereas everything's moved over to iOS. So that kind of on-device recovery would be really welcome.
Next thing, and we've mentioned this before, is a forced Bluetooth on. And I think the thing here is we're not looking to say, because the challenge would be is if you can't turn it off on the device, then if you need to do it for troubleshooting, you have to go in there and go to your MDM and remove the profile and change the profile. Like kind of like how VPN on demand works. Like if it's, you know, within a VPN provider that forces it on, you can flip it off and then it comes right back on. And same thing with Bluetooth. Like you can turn it off, but then it pops right back on.
And this is for things like Apple Classroom where, you know, Bluetooth is part of the operation of the whole thing. Kind of in that vein, though, the other thing I would like is on the iPad, I suppose on the phone as well, but this is more an iPad thing, the ability to, if you're connected to a Bluetooth keyboard on your iPad, to disconnect from that keyboard from the iPad and not from the keyboard. You've probably had this situation as well where you're using a Bluetooth keyboard at a desk, you pick up your iPad, you go over to the other side of the room or to another room, and then you try to type something, and no keyboard comes up because it's still connected to the keyboard that's in two rooms away from you now. But then the only way to do that is either to turn off Bluetooth on your iPad or go back and switch off the keyboard. So some way to do that without necessarily turning off Bluetooth would also be quite welcome.
This is a big one for battery life. For students, is limit the screen brightness.
Yeah, so just the ability to, you know, set a profile that says maximum screen brightness 75% or something like that. Because in most situations, except, you know, if you're doing, say, outdoor education, let's say, in most indoor situations, you do not need that last 25% of brightness, really and truly. Certainly not in Scotland, I don't know about other countries, but in Scotland, it's rarely that bright that you need that amount of light coming in your eyes. And certainly not for about eight months of the winter, where it's mostly dark here. So that, to me, that's kind of like the number one battery problem that I have with iOS. And it's not a problem as such, it's not a practical problem, but it is often the reason why, you know, later in a deployment, you know, 2.5 years in, people are coming to you for a charger and things like that during the day, A, because they didn't charge it 100%, but B, they're running the screen at full brightness all the time, which takes them over that edge. And even if they took it down to 60% or something, they would actually be getting the full day out of a, you know, 60% charge quite easily if they just, you know, were a bit more careful about the brightness.
Next thing is a master key for supervised devices.
Yeah, I'll explain why I want this. And even as I'm saying this, I'm thinking, you know, Apple's not in the, and they have shown themselves not to be in the business of making master keys for iOS devices. But the scenario where I want this, right, is quite often, you know, a lot of things can be controlled by MDM on an iPad, but not everything. And very occasionally, I'll get a situation where somebody wants me to fix a student's iPad and the student's not present to unlock the device. That's okay at the moment because I know their passwords, but I, you know, in principle and ideally, you would want the student to choose their own password and you not to know it. But I would still need a way into that device. And I think with managed Apple IDs, and again, we have neither of us have seen Apple School Manager, but I think the setup for a managed Apple ID is that the student has to choose their password. So in that case, you actually may not know the student's password such that you couldn't get into their device. So that's something that I think, you know, as managed Apple ID deployment kind of matures, the ability for a sysadmin to have a kind of skeleton key that gets them into devices that they themselves have supervised, I think there's a case for doing that, and presumably only on supervised devices and probably device enrollment devices as well, just to prove that they are absolutely school-owned devices. But people in that situation, there are reasons why you might want that, and I think it's not unreasonable, even if it is, you know, quite a large request considering Apple's general stance on privacy and security.
Yeah, it's like one of those, like, just this once, guys, just this once.
Yeah, that's the problem, is just this once is always twice.
So next thing is the ability to disable the Safari private browsing. And this would be good because you would know that the history was accurate.
Yeah, you wouldn't have any sort of missing loads or anything like that. And the second step in that is also preventing people from erasing Safari history as well. And there are certain configuration keys which can make Safari behave this way, but their implications are hard. Like, if I remember rightly, it's, you know, when you turn on the global content filter, on the on-device content filter, that does have an impact on both of these features. Like, it disables private browsing and it prevents you erasing the history, but the content filter is so aggressive in iOS that it's not really usable. You know, it blocks things like The Guardian or whatever. So just being able to turn on these controls by themselves without necessarily enforcing the content filter on the device, I think that would be very useful in school, because it's a useful situation because you don't necessarily want to block everything or lock everything down, but you just want a bit of accountability there. And knowing that that is that information is accurate and correct is something that schools could use quite usefully, I think.
Yes, yes. What's next? Ability to override App Store age ratings on a per app basis.
Yeah, so this comes from a situation which arose where we've got one half of this equation now, which is that you can, for any app, you can send it a profile that says, do not allow that app. So, for example, Snapchat, let's say, which is rated below our maximum age rating. Our kids who are allowed to install their own apps could install Snapchat. But what I've done is I've applied a profile where it said it includes the Snapchat bundle ID. And so even if you do have Snapchat installed it disappears from your iPad. And that's the one half of that. So that helps you deal with apps that you could get but don't want. The other side of this, though, is apps that you do want that you can't get because they're rated 17 plus. And a simple example of this is we were using the Amazon Workspaces app, which is a remote desktop app that lets you connect to a virtual PC in the Amazon cloud. And that app was rated 17 plus because it let you connect to a computer, which could then connect to the internet. But of course, what's kind of weird about all of this is that it's very inconsistent. So Screens VNC doesn't have that kind of level of rating, and neither does the Microsoft Remote Desktop Client, which lets you connect to a PC that is then connected to the internet. So there's a lot of inconsistency around there as well. Another app for a long time was 1Password, which, because it had an embedded browser, was considered to be, you know, full internet access and therefore 17 plus. Fortunately, now 1Password's got a lower rating because they've changed the way they're using the new Safari embedded controller, and that actually obeys the parental controls that you set on the device. So that is considered sufficient for an app with a browser built in to actually get a 4 plus rating rather than a 17 plus rating now. So more developers should do that as well, I think. But being able to sort of open up that as well for specific apps, I think, would also be a useful thing to be able to do.
Yeah, and these are, gosh, I looked through this list, and these are like minute things, but I think that's good. And I think these are systematic, as we said, that the platform's matured. And these are things like I wouldn't have thought about 3 years ago, but like as we continue to grow the platform, I'm thinking about.
Yeah, and as your experience develops, right, you know, back in the day, like you said, you know, I really need copy and paste, right, or I need two up apps, or I need a way to copy an app from somebody else's sandbox into my sandbox, and all of those things are there now. And now you're looking at kind of the next level of both control and productivity, I think. So some of these are long running requests, but we got so much from a school and a sysadmin point of view, we get so much in iOS 9.3 that I kind of almost feel ashamed for asking for more sysadmin features. But the limiting screen brightness is kind of one of the few that has been on my list for ages and we haven't got yet. The rest of these are kind of things that have almost arisen from the benefits of 9.3, and now we just want different ways to control certain aspects of that as well.
So, yeah, good stuff. We'll see here after WWDC, yep, what we find. So thanks, everybody, for listening this week. If you're new to the show, we have a way that listeners can support the show directly, and we have sponsors as well, and we appreciate them. But if you're wanting to send us $1 or $2 every month, we certainly appreciate that. We have a Patreon page on our website, and we obviously accept any amount, but we kind of have two different rewards. Number one is a $10 plus reward a month, and I like to mention those folks on the show. And so those folks this month are Envision Design LLC, Michael Slade, and Nicholas Cole Farrell. They all supported us with a donation of $10 a month or higher. And then we also have the people that are $3 a month or higher on our website. It's on the, we call it the Dean's List. And so that's on our website. We list those folks there. So again, we want to thank those folks for supporting us directly this month. And if you want to support the show directly, you can go to outofschool.net, and we have a Patreon page on there. So again, thank you all for supporting the show, and it helps us keep the lights on, pay the hosting bills as well. So we're coming up on 4 years of the show, and I was looking at our podcast hosts and seeing, like, we started this thing in 2012 with the hopes of doing 20 shows, so we're coming up on 200. So we definitely appreciate you guys being along for the ride.
I can't believe it's nearly 200 shows. That's crazy. What is this, episode 182 or something like that?
Yeah, what's crazy to me is 4 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
4 years. Look at times. So anyways, well, thanks everybody for listening and spending an hour or so with us this week. And we hope you have a fantastic week. I'm on Twitter at Bradley Chambers, and I'm on the web at chambersdaily.com.
Okay. And I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web.
Thanks, everybody.